the students. So that's made up to take in a complete spectrum of interested individuals in the university. We began meeting in March. One of our first things, one of the first things we did was to develop an interim complaint procedure, which I think has been mentioned on some of these programs already, so that any woman or minority individual who felt that he or she was being discriminated against would have some recourse, some method of trying to resolve the complaint within the university. Since that time, we've been deliberating quite intensively. We've been meeting on once a week or more often most of that time and discussing a plan, trying to work out an organization for a plan, and discussing many specific points that we would like to see in a plan. We're now well along. We started early this month, drew up a draft of a plan, and we've been meeting. Our last three or four meetings have been primarily to discuss this. We're revising it and going over it point by point, really discussing quite intensively. We hope by the end of this week to submit this plan to the Chancellor as a provisional plan for the university. I say provisional because a complete plan, according to federal regulations, has to include some detailed information on the present makeup of the workforce and some analyses of these, and detailed goals and timetables for correcting underutilization of women and minority groups. We don't have all the information yet for that part. So our plan is intended to be in effect during this interim period while the more detailed material can be assembled and then added in to make a full plan.
Shirley, what part will your office play in actualizing this plan?
Well, my office shares with the Office of Minority Affairs responsibility for monitoring certain practices which are recommended in the plan and which will be required if the plan is approved as it stands. Additionally, and perhaps more importantly, we will serve to assist all the people in the university as they go about actualizing the plan. My role is not one of being the actualizer, but rather helping all those many, many people who will have the responsibility for carrying it out. And I hope to help them in a lot of different ways. For example, if a department is looking for someone to fill a vacant position, they will hopefully want to interview all kinds of people for that job. If they have difficulty locating women who are qualified in the area which needs to be filled, I will help them find someone for the job or someone who will be considered as a candidate for the job. That's just one of the many ways I'll try to help.
So you're really a resource person to people in implementing the plan.
Yes, that's the way I view my responsibility.
Mm-hmm. Julie, you said that the plan will have to be approved. Now, what do you mean by approval? Who will grant this approval and what's involved?
Do you mean at the university level? Well, we'll submit this to the Chancellor. We're a Chancellor's committee, and we're supposed to develop recommendations to submit to him. Now, he will have to be the final person to say, go ahead with this plan, of course, and I imagine that he won't do that right away. He will probably want to ask others, university officials, to look at this and give us some feedback, and so there may be a period. I don't believe it'll be a very long period of considering changes, because I know that he would like to have a plan on hand when our compliance review comes from the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare, and that's expected fairly soon now.
Will this approval come without any, let's say, review by university governing boards like the Senate? Or will it ultimately have to go to the regents? Is it that kind of a thing?
I don't know whether the regents will have to approve everything in the plan. There will be some things in the plan that might take regents' action. I don't know. I had assumed that the chancellor would be the final person to approve this. There are, as I say, requests of the regents in various places in the plan, but otherwise I don't believe that they will be involved as a whole in the plan.
As we're talking about the provisional plan and about how it will be reviewed for acceptance, I think it might be relevant to mention that one of the plans of the Affirmative Action Board is that both the Office of Affirmative Action for Women and the Office of Minority Affairs will set up cluster groups. And that is, for example, a group for my office, a group of women from the classified staff of the university, another group of women students, perhaps a group of women graduate students, a group of women faculty, and so forth. And these cluster groups, we hope, will give us feedback about how they feel about the provisional plan. And then when we're ready to formulate the final plan, we will have some input from everybody who's involved in the university. We, of course, would like to have done that before we wrote the provisional plan, but during the summer when we were putting it together, too many people were away from the campus. And that really is at the heart of the idea of having a provisional plan. Although it is very precise and we think complete, we know that others will be able to provide some valuable input.
Betty, do you think that faculty women have a great interest in the plan and will want to make some inputs?
I should certainly think so. And I've been involved at least last year with AAUP Committee W, and there is a group with a great deal of interest in this. In fact, some of us served on the grievance board that was mentioned earlier, and I think that that's a continuing interest, and so there should be no problem about finding faculty women with an interest in the kind of proposals that are being made.
When I was talking about the cluster groups, I failed to mention one very important group of which I am a member, and I should add that, and that is the unclassified non-faculty people who work throughout the university. We're a rather amorphous group because we're widely scattered, and we're not we don't have a central organization as most of the other groups do have, but we are also very much interested in hearing from women who serve in these kinds of positions, the unclassified non-faculty.
When you refer to classified employees of the university, you're talking about civil service employees.
That's right.
And then the other people who are being talked about in the Affirmative Action Plan or the other groups would be students is an area.
There is a student section, yes.
And classified faculty and then your own situation of being unclassified. What are some examples, besides yourself, of people who are unclassified?
A woman counselor in the Guidance Bureau, a woman in Extramural Independent Study Center who works with correspondence courses and counsels students with that. You yourself, mm-hmm. Janet, Assistant Dean of Women.
So it's really a sort of a diverse group of people who do.
Yes, it's quite diverse. It includes people who are doing research and people who are working in student services. And it's really difficult for us to know who we are, you know. Mm-hmm. And I always hesitate to give examples because I'm afraid I'll leave out a very important example without intending to do so.
Well, I think that one of the differences is one you pointed out already, that there isn't a governing body or like a student senate committee or a faculty senate committee to reach this group of people as easily.
Right.
How large a group is it?
I don't know. I'll know better after we've collected the support data, which is being required by HEW, and which will serve as the basis for our goals and timetables, which will be established later. But so there are many side benefits of the support data that we're being required to collect.
You asked one question, Betty, that we didn't answer yet, and that was to what extent the government of the university government structure would be involved mm-hmm. in reviewing the plan. I really don't know. I imagine in the case of this provisional plan that it won't be able to go through any full review by the governing structure because of the time pressure involved. But I'm sure that the final plan, I shouldn't say I'm sure, I feel fairly sure that the Chancellor will want to involve the university governing structure to a greater extent in the final plan, that we will have more time based on the feedback and on the detailed information, we'll have more time to develop that in a more gradual way.
Now, it would seem to me that it would be something that would be desirable, but perhaps difficult
yes.
to know exactly how to work. Because it's certainly ill.
On the other hand, for a plan to succeed, it really needs involvement of everyone. That's one of the things we've thought about quite a great deal and tried to build into our provisional plan, ways of getting everybody involved, knowledgeable and involved and interested, because the plan can't succeed unless an awful lot of people in an awful lot of positions know what is involved and are interested in furthering it.
Be a good educational opportunity, because certainly that must be one of the major stumbling blocks, as we were talking even before the program about people who refuse to admit that there really are difficulties here. And so certainly that would be a wonderful opportunity to present the facts and get a lot of support, hopefully.
There is a great deal of misunderstanding about what affirmative action is.
Right.
In some parts of the university, I find people who think that affirmative action is only for women. In other parts of the university, I find people who think affirmative action is only for minority persons. And actually, of course, it's for all of what HEW calls affected classes.
In some of the supporting data that you're submitting with the plan, have you been able to prove that this will be beneficial to the university as a whole in providing affirmative action for these affected groups? Do you think that it is positive? Can it benefit the people who might be resisting it in some ways?
I'm not sure where the resistance comes from. So that's a rather difficult question to answer. The support data really is going to result in a description, a general description of the employees of the university, the permanent employees. It will show us where in the hierarchy of job classifications women and minority persons are found and in what proportions. So it's going to be very revealing when it is compiled, and we have to go through a process of collection of information about all the employees. Then that information will be put through what is called a utilization analysis, which sounds terribly impressive, I think. But what it really means is how many women and minorities is the university employing and in what capacities, so that we may have a great many women serving as clerk typists, but not very many women at all serving as administrators. And this is the kind of information that will come out of the utilization analysis.
And then on the basis of this information, this plan will set goals to change these figures. Is that correct?
Well, not necessarily to change them. For example, in the Department of Human Development and Family Life, we know that there are 54% of the faculty there are women. Now, one would not need to change that. That is, as it should be, when you consider the number of women in the population. However, where the utilization analysis reveals underutilization of women or of minorities, then some goals will be established. And this should not be confused with quotas, which is quite a different thing. A quota is a set number of people whom you have to employ from a certain category. A goal, on the other hand, should simply reflect the number of women or minorities available in the total workforce. And this is a kind of yardstick by which we can measure our own utilization. In the case of women faculty, we'll look at one measure which has been used rather widely and which I think is pretty fair, is what proportion of the doctorates in each discipline were earned by women during the past decade. And all of those figures are readily available. In fact, I have quite a file built up in my office. So that if a department in the university has no women on its faculty, and yet we know that 32% of the doctorates in that field were earned by women in the last 10 years, then we can safely say that that department is underutilizing women.
Well, then in this process, there shouldn't be any compromise of the quality of instruction or the quality of the people employed.
Oh, none whatever. In fact, we hope that women who find positions at this university will raise its standards even higher.
One important factor in the plan in this respect is that the point is to broaden the recruitment base, to recruit from populations that have usually been left out of the process, to advertise or to publicize openings far enough to reach minorities and women who might otherwise never have heard of them. Now, this can't help but be beneficial, because the more people who are aware of an opening and apply for it, the more greater the chance of getting people who really would be good to have at the school. And I think all schools will benefit in this way by reaching farther and trying to get in and find out about, you know, and inform groups where there may be potential applicants. This way you give yourself a better chance. You can hardly hurt yourself by opening up recruitment to a larger population.
And women and minority people do have a need to be encouraged to seek positions. Too many times we have been turned away, ignored, refused consideration, so that many universities now, when they announce a vacancy, will say applications from women and minority persons are encouraged. And this, of course, facilitates the implementation of their affirmative action plan, and also tells those of us who are part of the affected classes that we are welcome there, which is good.
Betty, do you think this will be a real difference from the way recruitment is handled now in the cases that you're familiar with?
Oh, I think so. I think that there is such a, that the attitude is so strong that in many areas that a woman is not a good risk. And once women have been given some opportunities and proof that they stay on with their employment and can handle situations as well or as better as men, why they certainly, I think, you'll find it a change in the pattern of employment in many areas.
Does this sort of open acknowledgement and publication of openings take place now, or is it how is it handled now at the present time in most departments?
I know that at least in some departments that I have direct contact with, there's no open publicizing of positions. Many departments, someone in the department, or maybe perhaps several department members, write to schools that they feel would be good places to recruit from, or write to friends of theirs in other schools mentioning an opening and asking for suggestions. I would imagine it's handled this way in most departments, but I can't say for sure. Mm-hmm. Certainly the ones I've had experience with, this seems to be the usual pattern, so that many openings aren't even known, you know, except by people who get contacted from this limited network. Mm-hmm. Many schools now are beginning to publicize openings more widely because they have gone into this affirmative action area. But until recently, it was looked on as a rather... an institution with prestige didn't do this. Only lesser institutions would openly ask for people. Somehow it was looked on as undignified.
And I know we have an employment, sort of an employment service for classics in which booklets are published and one thing or another. And someone that I know comes from has a PhD from a well-known Eastern university said, well, we were told not to put ourselves in the book because it was sort of beneath us to engage in that kind of commercialism.
That's exactly the attitude. And the institution would feel, oh, you know, we don't advertise or mention this openly to the public, you know. Maybe some other school, second-rate school does, but we wouldn't do a thing like that.
And this varied from department to department within the university, too, the way they went about the process.
Well, I would say that in the major universities, probably they never advertised openings in the academic departments.
Mm-hmm. Now, this will affect the faculty. What kinds of things might affect classified or students as far as affirmative action?
Well, again, publicizing openings is of importance. It's a different group, of course, that's involved there. Not generally, it doesn't. Now, students, of course, can come from a national pool. So, especially graduate students, we draw quite heavily on not just Kansas, but the nation as a whole. The classified staff come primarily from the local area. But even within a local area, you can publicize in ways to reach women and minorities more effectively, particularly minority groups. For instance, with Haskell Institute here, we can certainly increase our publicity. Actually, even for students, this might be a source of students here that we haven't fully exploited. so that advertising there is also important. There are many other things, such as considering the qualifications of the people presently in the classified and being sure that if people are qualified for higher level positions in the civil service, that they get the chance to fill them when openings occur. So we do have a whole set of principles, some of them similar, some of them a little different because of the different pool people that we're calling upon for classified positions.
What are some of the other areas besides recruitment that might be covered in the affirmative action kinds of proposals?
I hesitate to go into them in too much detail because I don't know how much they'll change before we finally get out, have them approved. We have material on promotions, which is, of course, I'd say another very important area, tenure also in cases where that applies, financial aids in the case of students, things like health service in case of women, matters dealing with maternity, leave, benefits, and so on. Some statements on other issues that seem far removed until you get into this and realize how all embracing a concept of affirmative action can be, material on housing. One has to consider the total environment, really, in order to design an effective affirmative action plan, because all aspects of the lives of minority and women students and faculty, classified staff, and others are important in order to attract people and to correct our underutilization.
So really, almost every area of the university might be affected by the implementation of an affirmative action plan.
Very definitely. And actually, according to federal guidelines that we are operating under, we're even supposed to be concerned with community affairs because the people who come here, particularly minorities and to some extent women and families of people here, will be involved in the communities, perhaps seeking employment there, so that the whole community structure becomes important to the university.
We'll continue with our discussion of proposals to end sex discrimination at the University of Kansas following the station break.
This is Jim Seaver, inviting you to listen in for Opera is My Hobby at 8 o'clock Friday evening. At that time, we'll be hearing recordings from Leoncavallo's famous opera, Pagliacci. I'm going to focus in this program on the role of Canio in the opera. Canio is one of the most famous roles for tenor, of course, in all of the operatic repertoire. It was the part, as an example, most associated with Enrico Caruso during his reign at the Metropolitan in the first 20 years of this century, and possibly Martinelli's greatest part also as successor to Caruso. But there were many other great Canios too, and so I plan to play recordings from a number of them. For instance, Paoli and Merrily will sing Un Grande Spettacolo from the Act One of the opera, Zenatello and Gigli, Un Tal Gioco, the second short aria for Canio in Act One, and the famous lament Vesti la Giubba, of course, will be done by Caruso and Martinelli, probably the most famous of all interpreters of the part. From Act Two, we'll be hearing the tragic No Pagliaccio Non Son by Aureliano Pertile and Jussi Björling, and the dramatic finale of the opera with this exciting La Commedia Finita by Mario Del Monaco and Placido Domingo, who, of course, is the present Canio at our Metropolitan. So, for a galaxy of great tenors as Canio in Pagliacci, listen in for Opera Is My Hobby.
This is Janet Sears, substituting for Dr. Taylor, and tonight we are discussing affirmative action plans to end sex discrimination at KU. Our guests this evening are Dr. Julie Schaefer, chairwoman of the Affirmative Action Board, Shirley Gillum, director of the Office of Affirmative Action for Women at the University of Kansas, and Dr. Betty Banks from the Classics Department, who has been involved over the past few years in affirmative action plans for women and active in the committee WAAUP. We were talking about the far-reaching effects that affirmative action plans might have, that they will reach almost every part of the university and even into the community. I think one area in the community that would be involved would be finding housing for minorities or for women or single women with children. Then that this would be an area where there might be some discrimination existing currently that would have to be affected.
Well, we know that on occasion minority persons who were being considered for positions on the faculty have been, I don't know exactly how to say this, but one of the considerations has been, would that person want to live in this community? And sometimes the conclusion is, well, no, they probably wouldn't. So we know that housing is a problem, or the total environment of the community can be a problem. I'm not sure that excuse is a justifiable one in the case of the city of Lawrence. You know,
mm-hmm.
I think that kind of thing can be used to perhaps perpetuate discrimination.
Well, you mean in some instances the department might give that as an excuse why someone wouldn't come when
mm-hmm.
when really there,
mm-hmm.
the effort hadn't been complete in
right.
making them feel comfortable here.
Right, that can happen.
Mm-hmm.
Housing is very important, certainly. Transportation is another thing somewhat along those lines, but for being sure that, for instance, if you want to attract more people onto the staff from the minority community in town, then you have to consider transportation to work. And actually, I was talking to someone involved in affirmative action at Rutgers at a conference I went to in the spring, and they have a whole department concerned with housing and transportation, a whole office within their total affirmative action effort concerned with those matters, so they can be quite important.
How is something like that handled in terms of improving the situation? Did you get any idea of how they work it there?
They hadn't done enough at the time I talked to her, and she was actually involved in a different area of the plan, so that I didn't get that. I was only surprised to hear that this was a whole office by itself that dealt just with those problems.
Could be very difficult, it would seem.
Very, and I think what you find when you get into this is that you're surprised over and over by the number of things you do have to think about, and you finally begin to realize how all-encompassing you have to be to work out a successful plan.
Has that been one of the problems that you have faced in sort of defining the limits of your activity?
Yes, I think it's a problem in the sense that we decide on something and then we realize we really ought to consider some other area, and it seems to be almost a never-ending process, no, except that sooner or later we're going to just have to decide to stop. I'm sure if we went on discussing, we could just keep on adding points. In fact, since we started our discussions of this, trying to get this provisional plan into shape, it just keeps getting added to. It's expanded greatly since our first draft came out, because we have all thought of other areas that we should be sure to include. And no doubt there'll be many that aren't in it. We have very little right now really dealing with. I mentioned housing, but I'm sure that in a final plan there will have to be much more. One of the things we've given as something that we hope the Office of Affirmative Action for Women and the Office of Minority Affairs will do is establish liaisons with the community organizations in this area, like the Lawrence Human Relations Commission, and work on problems in the community in relation to the university. So that's a whole area that we've really dealt very little with in this plan.
Actually, the job of preparing an affirmative action plan, difficult though it is made a good deal simpler by the famous Order Number 4, which serves as our Bible and our reference book. It's a rather lengthy document, but it describes in some detail precisely what an affirmative action plan must do and the areas which it must cover. That is not to say that it can't go beyond that, but it must at least cover certain things, and that list is quite lengthy. And each one, of course, as we prepare the plan, we read and reread and reread Order Number 4, which and as many times as I've read it, I still have to go back to it again, because it's an information-packed document.
Well, now, this is different from the HEW guidelines, isn't it? This summer, there was a great deal of discussion in the local press about waiting to formulate our affirmative action plan for KU until we got a list of guidelines from HEW. What was this? And
well, you see, Order Number 4, which is very useful and describes how to go about establishing affirmative action, was actually written for businesses and industries. Now, the problem is to interpret Order Number 4 in such a way that it fits the university. And it does fit pretty well. There are references to a few things which simply don't apply to the university, but most of the things do fit. Well, in order to end whatever confusion there may be because of the terms and the used in the present Order Number 4, HEW is in the process of preparing guidelines written specifically for colleges and universities.
And but they still haven't appeared then?
Well, they have appeared to a certain extent. They have appeared to the extent that someone, and I'm sorry I can't remember who, sent out a synopsis of what the guidelines are going to contain. But the health, education, and welfare lawyers are still working with the guidelines, and those guidelines aren't ready for release. Julie, didn't you say that they'd be done by the end of the year?
That's the latest word. What I understand is that a first draft of the guidelines has been circulated among a limited group of people. I don't know who. No one here has received it, as far as I know, for discussion, and that this will be fed back into HEW, and that they will, from this, revise these, and when they're ready, send this out to everyone. It's been promised for a long time. The last word was that it should be here before the end of this year. However, as Shirley pointed out, we don't have to wait, because the revised Order Number 4, which is issued by the Office of Federal Contract Compliance, does apply to us, even though it wasn't formulated with universities in mind, so that the language is a little hard in spots to interpret in connection with universities. It does apply to universities. We are ultimately under the Department of Labor, so that everything in there does apply to us, and we are governed by the regulations in that order, so that after you read it for a while, you begin to be less bothered by the different language that sounds like it doesn't apply. You begin to see that you can't apply much of it in the university context. So that we have been, it would have been nice to have the guidelines from AGW written specifically for schools. But it hasn't really meant that we couldn't do anything, the fact that we haven't gotten these guidelines.
I discussed the guideline question with Mr. J.L. Thomas, who is chief of the Contract Compliance Division in our regional office in Kansas City, and the man who will be heading up the team, the review team, which will come here sometime this fall. I mentioned that we were anxious to see guidelines, and he said, well, really, don't anticipate any changes. You might anticipate some additions, but no deletions. Mm-hmm. So we are at least on the right track with our plan, which is really based on Order Number 4, interpreted in the light of the needs of the University of Kansas, which is, of course, a unique situation. As we review the proposed plans of the different schools and universities across the country, we occasionally come across a few which are almost identical to one another. Our plan is really not copied from anybody else's. We considered, you know, how much can we profit from studying other universities' plans, and the general conclusion was that this is the University of Kansas. It's not Columbia University, and it's not the University of Michigan, and we're different here. Although we have many things in common, we do feel that our plan should be precisely tailored to this university, and we've tried to make it so.
Before we continue our discussion, I'd like to invite any listeners to call in if they have any questions concerning affirmative action. The number is 864-4530. As we're waiting for the plan to be made public and approved, are there some areas of the university that are going ahead and initiating their own affirmative action programs, or at least aware of the problems of sex discrimination and trying to make some changes?
Well, the library has had for some time, and I'm sorry, I don't know exactly how long, an affirmative action task force for women. The women in the library have worked very hard on compiling statistics, investigating salaries, investigating promotion, and all of the other things that figure into employment. They have, in fact, within the past month, completed their survey of the situation in the library and have prepared a report which has been submitted to the library director. And that report, of course, contains recommendations, and they've done a really fine job, I think, of looking into it.
Well, they started, I think, last spring, because the question arose when the University Affirmative Action Board was appointed, whether they should stop the activity that they were starting on.
Oh.
I remember that Julie said, by all means, no, go ahead, and they have been able to pursue it. Karen was on the program last, mm-hmm. Karen Zimmerman, last
right.
week.
Well, it's very, very helpful mm-hmm. when various segments of the university decide mm-hmm. to go ahead on mm-hmm. their own, because eventually everyone's going to be involved in affirmative action anyway.
When you were saying that the union has an affirmative action
yes,
committee.
For mm-hmm. women. And that committee has just started their work within the last 2 weeks, but they are moving ahead very, very well with it. And the women in the union are involved in participating and free to participate as much as they wish, or as little as they wish, of course. We certainly shouldn't neglect to mention the affirmative action provision or interim affirmative action plan of the Office of Business Affairs, which was set up to function, and while the board, affirmative action board, is preparing the university-wide plan, Business Affairs has had its own.
So we're not really just all waiting for this plan. There
yes.
are things going on now
I was going to say it's certainly confusing in a way to have lots of different people working on their own to develop plans, but it's far more desirable to have a confusing situation than to have a situation where no one's doing anything and in fact everyone feels all you can do is wait until the major plan comes along. I think I certainly would much rather suffer through the confusion and feel that people are really acting all around, even though we may have trouble coordinating everything, at least. I really feel that I have always encouraged people who wanted to go ahead to do something to get going and not wait around for anything to come out centrally.
This is true. The involvement of individuals and of departments and so forth is going on at all levels and in very small ways and in very big ways. And I get phone calls all the time from people who say, now, what we want to do, what we hope to do is this, and how do you think we could go about it? Or is there anything wrong with our trying this approach? So that it's really encouraging to talk to these people because they're interested and they're excited. And in the graduate program in one department, The admissions committee is working very hard to see that there are women and that there are minority people who are being admitted to the program, and they're watching that and they're trying to do everything they can to facilitate the entry of women and minorities into the profession by getting them into the postgraduate program. Which, of course, is extremely important. We must be concerned about graduate-level education. This is the source of faculty members, and unless we provide now for the future, when we'll never reach those goals and our timetables will be useless.
Well, surely from the activity in your office, then you feel like there's a lot going on in the university.
Oh, yeah.
Well, if a woman feels that she is being discriminated against on the basis of her sex at this point, what can she do?
Well, she can come to Room 7 Strong Hall and ask to talk to Shirley Gillum, and that's the first step.
Uh-huh.
Then I will discuss with her the various options which are open to her, and of course we'll discuss the situation with her. And I can, first of all, recommend to her our complaint procedure, which has proven to be very effective.
Now, can she remain anonymous through this process, through the complaint procedure?
Well, she can't remain completely anonymous. In other words, she's going to have to eventually face the person she is complaining against. And many women, I must admit, are reluctant to file a complaint because they feel that They will suffer consequences later.
Mm-hmm.
I try to always point out to them that this is illegal. If a woman or any person complains that she is discriminated against, it is a crime punishable by law for the employer or whoever it is to in turn do something to punish her for that.
Shirley, I think maybe we should point out that she can remain anonymous in the initial stages, certainly. When she comes to talk to you,
she's still
anonymous.
Yes. Right.
She gets together with a small group of women to go over the facts of the complaint and so on and have them discuss it with her. She's still anonymous.
Well,
so she's anonymous except
to those people
who are involved in helping.
It's
still confidential, only if it gets to the point where they feel she has a real case and they want to go out and start trying to help her, so that they would have to speak to some of the people concerned. Only at that point would the question come up.
Right. It might be a good idea to just talk about the steps in the procedure.
Okay.
And the first one is that she talk with me. Then we have the first step. Talking with me is a preliminary. The first step in the procedure is a consultation with what is called the Advisory Review Committee. This past summer, some members of Committee W very graciously served as this advisory review committee, four people. Unfortunately, the load became a little heavy. And so in searching for a way to take some of the responsibility, that heavy responsibility, off every member of the group. This fall, we are setting up a committee of 24, which is, you know, a much better sized group. And that committee will include representatives from undergraduates, graduate students, faculty women, unclassified staff, and classified staff. So when the complaint is registered and if the individual decides to pursue it, then she will select from this list of people on the committee three names, and those three people will work with her in the initial stage, which is a very informal process.
So I think one of the advantages is that even if a woman merely suspects that something may not be quite right, you can still start out in this initial phase. You're not blasting anyone at this point. You're just kind of investigating and questioning, and it's perfectly appropriate to go
right.
If you have any suspicion that
and you don't have
not
to have
quite
proof
right.
At that point either.
It's very hard
no.
To have proof, as we know when we work with things like this. So that's the point. It isn't necessary to be able to prove anything, but if you have any grounds for suspecting, this is the time to go in and start at least on this informal level exploring the situation.
And very often a solution can be found at that stage without going any farther. But if no solution appears, the next part of the process is to conduct informal discussion. And I have great faith in this process because it does not polarize the people who are involved.
This is with the person making the complaint and the person against whom the complaint is made?
Yes, and in fact, at this first level of the complaint procedure, those two people need never meet. They don't have to encounter each other, even. Members of the advisory review committee can speak on behalf of the person who is having the difficulty. We find, and all summer we didn't get past this stage of the complaint procedure, things were resolved at this level. And there were no ill feelings between the people involved. And I felt that there was a happy solution to every problem which came before the committee.
You mentioned that there's a parallel structure in the Office of Minority Affairs, so that any minority person who feels discriminated against can go there, and there are review committees, an advisory review committee there made of minority people to do the same, go through the same process. Now, a minority woman, I would assume, could either choose either office or else ask both offices to become involved jointly in this procedure.
Have you had many women take advantage of this process for making a complaint?
Not a great many, no.
Like 3, 5, 10?
Three last summer, mm-hmm. And none this fall.
I think part of the problem is that we must get the procedure publicized.
Mm-hmm.
It was only adopted last spring and has not been widely publicized yet. And so part of what we're doing here, I hope, is publicizing it so that
mm-hmm. Well, I think
who have complaints know that there is a procedure.
Mm-hmm. I think it's important that the things you pointed out, that you don't have to have proof, you can just have a sort of feeling, and someone else will help you explore that before you make any sort of accusations. And I think perhaps maybe more people will take advantage of it.
Yeah, I'd also like to say that sometimes a complaint will not go through the complaint procedure. Sometimes, if a woman will simply call attention to a problem, then I can call that problem to the attention of somebody in a position to do something to change the situation without ever getting involved in accusations and a formal complaint procedure. You see, I really have faith in this, that everybody in this university wants to do the thing which is best for all people concerned, so that if a problem exists and if they're aware of the problem, they will will attempt to resolve it or to remove the thing which is causing the problem.
Let's suppose that the problem isn't resolved at the informal discussion level. Then what kind of steps are there beyond that?
Okay, at the next step is that the complaint is taken before the University Human Relations Committee.
Mm.
With one member of the advisory review committee acting as this, either a support person or a spokesperson or whatever that the complainant wants that person to do. And if that fails, then there is it can come before the Affirmative Action Board, isn't that correct? Or does it go to the judiciary?
Well, it depends at that point. It could be appealed to the judiciary, or if the Human Relations Committee makes a finding and then the person the complaint is against refuses to implement or does not implement the recommendations, right, then the person complaining can come to the Affirmative Action Board.
Right.
Now, we hope that things will not have to go to that extreme. I'm sure that the majority won't, but there is a procedure for going on to farther levels if the informal level doesn't work out.
Now, the University Human Relations Committee is an appointed committee, isn't it? Appointed by CENEX, just to clarify what that is. It's a regular committee of University Senate with student and faculty members.
Right.
No classified anything like that. And the committee is appointed, the chairman is appointed by CENEX. Is that the way it works?
Right. Yeah.
Do you think that step will stand in any tentative or final proposals for affirmative action?
Well, it's hard to say. It's going to depend to a certain extent on the kind of feedback we get from the cluster groups.
Mm-hmm.
If we find, for example, that people who are unclassified non-faculty and people who are classified employees of the university aren't satisfied with that, then we'll probably have to seek a better solution.
No, because it would seem to me there's so many things about it that aren't very satisfactory. And that it might be a step that could be.
Yeah, extra members can be added to the committee.
They can?
Yes.
Ah.
And, of course, now the Organization and Administration Committee is considering changes in the code.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And
affecting committee structure.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And so some of those changes will help to remedy some of the problems in the way the committee's set up. But there may have to be more done in this respect. Shirley spent quite a bit of time with that committee, giving, and we discussed some of the things we wanted to recommend for changes in the code that would affect the whole affirmative action area, and we hope that there will be some changes that will be of benefit in the affirmative action program.
What got us started on that is that when we attended a contract compliance review conference, one of the speakers who was at that time the head of the Civil Rights Office in Washington said that when we conduct an on-site review at a university, we expect to find women and minorities serving on all policy-making committees, which I think is probably a very good idea.
We're drawing near to the end of our program this evening. I do want to ask one more question of you, Julie. When do you expect that the affirmative action proposal will be public, in the sense that interested parties in the university could have access to it?
I wish I could answer it. I know that we expect to get it to the chancellor, our recommended provisional plan, by the end of this week. The rest is up to him.
Okay.
I don't think he'll delay long, but I assume he will want some feedback from others, and so I would say it shouldn't be too long, but I couldn't say exactly because it doesn't depend on us.
Okay. Well, I hope that our listeners have at least know now that they don't have to wait for the plan if they do have a complaint about discrimination on account of sex or race, that there is a procedure that they can take advantage of now, and one that hopefully will allow some resolution of their difficulties. So I want to thank Dr. Schaefer and Shirley Gillum and Dr. Banks for being with us this evening. I also want to announce that on October 12th, Shirley Chisholm will be on campus speaking in Hoke Auditorium, and during that week there will be a symposium on women in politics, and the Women's Political Caucus from Lawrence will be taking part in that. There will be information on NOW, on the Women's Equity Action League, and other ways in which women can become involved in the political process. If you have any questions or would like additional information, I hope you'll call our office. A Feminist Perspective is brought to you by the Office of Women's Resources and Career Planning, located in the Dean of Women's Office at 222 Strong Hall. If you would like any further information or have any questions you would like to raise, I hope you will call our office or come by at any time. And next week, Dr. Taylor will be back with you to continue the series of programs.